This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you work 40 hours a week, you probably spend more time with your colleagues than with the other people in your life. Studies have shown that relationships with coworkers play an important role in our lives. When workers have office friends, they're often happier, and often that's good for business. But of course, when coworkers don't get along, it can have a contagious effect. So what is a healthy office friendship? What can managers do to foster good relationships among employees? And what about the relationship between the boss and the staff that they manage? We have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Sigal Barsad. She's a professor at of management at the Wharton School. In fact, the Joseph Frank Bernstein Professor of Management at Wharton. And Sigal, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Wonderful to be here.
I should add that her research focuses on emotions and relationships in the workplace. And joining us by telephone is Peter Bregman. He's CEO of Bregman Partners. That's a global management consulting firm. And he's the author most recently of a book called 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distraction, and Get the Right Things Done. He's a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, Forbes, and others. And Peter Bregman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Really nice to be here.
Let me begin with you, Sigal, but Peter, I'd also like to get you in on the conversation. This is kind of a broad, generic-y kind of question, but I was thinking about last night as I was putting my questions together, do you think this is an unappreciated part of our relationship world, the fact that we spend so much time with the people that we work with that we don't think about them as much as perhaps we do our friends?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When we think about work, sometimes the perception is that we come in tabula rasa, we forget that we're people. And, you know, just do the task, do the work. But in fact, what we know is as a species, we have a huge need for affiliation. It matters a lot to how happy we are. And not only that, but how productive we are. And so people aren't always as aware of that as you might think.
What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that it's challenging because there are so many other dynamics at work. And we have so many sort of cultural rules around what you can do and what you can't do and who you can be and who you can't be in a workplace. So I think it gets very complicated, and I think it's great to have the conversation because so much of who we are at work is related to who we are as people, obviously, because that doesn't change. Right. So I'm in agreement.
Well, Sigal, you write about something, or you have called this companionate love.
Yes.
This is how we should perhaps think about perhaps the positive kind of relationships that we have at work. Flesh that out for us.
Absolutely. So I should first differentiate companionate love is different than romantic love, although that can also happen at work. But the work that I did with Mandy O'Neill, my co-author on this, is we looked at something called a culture of companionate love, which are the values a group or an organization has around expressing caring, compassion, affection, and tenderness in the workplace. And what we found, you know, companies spend so much time on what we call cognitive culture. So those are shared norms of how we think. But there's also emotional culture, which are shared values around what we should express at work. Mm. And what we found in a long-term care setting was that having a strong culture of companionate love led to less burnout, less absenteeism, which is a hard measure. But more than that, it rippled out to the people around the employees. And so it led to actually better patient outcomes as well and better family outcomes. So this doesn't just help the employees. It actually helps everyone in the organization.
What does that look like, though? I mean, and when someone is doing companionate love, what are we seeing? What are they doing?
So my two favorite examples, one actually would come from tax season. So what companionate love looks like is you're in the middle of tax season and you're a top tax accountant comes in and says, you know, somebody died in my family. I know we're in the height of tax season, but I have to go. And inside, the manager's like, no, can't you delay the funeral? You know, but in fact, what they do instead is they take a deep breath and they say, of course you should go. And don't worry, we'll take care of it. And what that does is it demonstrates to that tax accountant saying, wow, this is how we do things around here. This is how we treat each other. But my second, actually most favorite example is much more the day-to-day things, which is we treat each other kindly. And, you know, you see a stressed coworker and you bring him some pretzels and something to drink and civility and care. So it's not the big gestures. The big gestures are useful, but it's really the day-to-day caring and compassion that makes a difference.
And asking people about their lives or how, you know, your child was sick yesterday.
Yes.
How are they doing any better today?
Exactly.
Those little things. Peter, does that make sense to you?
It does. I think it's I love, first of all, I love the idea. I love your work, y'all.
Thank you.
and I love this idea of, you know, of tenderness. Like, that's such a great concept in work. Because it's so important in our lives, and yet it's so antithetical to, like, a word or a way of thinking. Like, when I go into work, I'm going to really focus on being tender with the people around me.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really interesting question to say what makes for friendship. So I think this issue of, you know, my uncle died and I have to go to the funeral, it's compelling, and it's also pretty straightforward. I mean, there's, you know, it's almost like you're just kind of a jerk if you say don't go to the funeral. So it's not like the bar for friendship at that move is pretty low. But so my question as I think about this is, how do you raise the bar?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what friends do for each other is they make sacrifices for each other. Like, I'm willing to make a sacrifice for someone. So I'm willing to take someone's workload if their workload is too heavy. I'm willing to, you know, maybe not just even ask how are you doing, but to notice something's going on for you and give you the benefit of the doubt and maybe take a hit to my business in order to support your business, which ultimately we believe will support the larger business as a whole. So it gets tricky when, especially at senior levels in an organization, when you look at business outcomes and friendships and how to how one impacts the other and what it really means to be a friend and how that ends up impacting the business, I think gets, you know, when I think about working with people at senior levels of organizations, I think that's where it gets really tricky.
Well, and which I think raises a question, and I'll put this to you, Sigal, which is what can managers, what can bosses do to foster these kinds of relationships? And do you think that they recognize their value, not just to have a happy workforce, but mm-hmm. actually maybe it's good for business.
Right, right. Well, so they should. The research shows that they should definitely recognize the value. Study after study after study shows that friendships influence all sorts of things, from performance and engagement and commitment. And actually, there's some wonderful work on people leaving less when they are there have friends at work rather than – and leaving more, by the way, when their friends leave. The one thing I really want to bounce off there is there are different reasons and types of friendships that happen in the workplace. And some of them, like we've been talking about, are more emotions-based. So they're about trust and emotional connection and exactly what you were just talking about. Some of them are more cognitively based. So it's based on sanity check, sense-making at work, things like that. Some of them are instrumental, mm-hmm. actually, in the sense of, you know, can I get things done through you? And interestingly, shared work tasks, which one would think would be one of the biggest things, it matters, but not as much as these other things that I just mentioned.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, Peter, even going back to you, and I was thinking about, you know, is there a difference, you think, between the friends that we have at work, and of course there are all kinds of friendships, and the ones that we have outside of work? Because as you said, there are, you know, there's certain rules at work. There's hierarchy at work. So it's not as if they're exactly the same, but, you know, sometimes it feels that way.
Yeah, and I think even out of work, there's different kinds of friendships. So, you know, if you think about the friendship that I have with my wife, which is, you know, a deeper than just a friendship, obviously, but it's also a work relationship when you think about it, right? that Eleanor, my wife, Eleanor and I have to negotiate a number of things, of shared responsibilities that we have around family, around children, around. And so,
you know what, Peter, we're going to, only because your phone is breaking up and we cannot hear what you are saying, and we want to make sure that we can. So we're going to hang up on you, call you back, and get you back on the line. But let me turn to you, Sigal, mm-hmm. which is just, you know, thinking about, yes, as you say, we're social creatures. We come to work. Mm-hmm. That doesn't stop here.
Mm-hmm.
But there are rules at work.
Right.
You know, and there is hierarchy at work.
Yeah. And the thing about that is, so there is some evidence that shows that one of the things that managers could do to promote sort of useful friendships is to have something called interactive justice or interactional justice, which is that you're very transparent about what's going on and about, in general, how the workplace operates. And that helps with a lot of the thornier issues. And, you know, the cross-level friendships, the supervisor with subordinate, again, if you have a – the thing about a culture of companionate love is that it's not at just one level of the organization, or it's not stratified like a cake. You know, you can only deal with people at a certain level. Actually, many of the examples that we got in that research were the cross-level examples, and not just from manager downward, but also employees upward to management. And so, sure, there are dicey issues if it looks like there's favoritism, but that's the other thing that where culture comes in, which is if everybody is treating everyone better and with caring and compassion and tenderness, then it's not as if it's just this kind of unique situation.
You have done research on contagion, and there can be, you know, positive contagion and negative contagion. And let me, since we've been talking about companionate love, let me talk a little bit about when things go bad or when people's friendships fall apart at work.
Right.
I don't know how you contain that or what the contagion of that is.
Yeah. So emotional contagion, the idea behind emotional contagion is that we catch emotions from one another like viruses, basically. And the way that it works is primarily subconscious. And so literally it comes from behavioral mimicry. So we mimic each other. And then what happens is for a variety of functions, we actually feel the emotion.
Wow.
And what's really interesting about contagion is that people almost never realize it's happening. And that is fairly insidious, actually, because if you meet with, let's say, a friend or somebody at work and they're really stressed, and you catch that and you leave that meeting and now you're stressed, most people don't think, oh, I'm just stressed because my friend is stressed. They own that stress, and then they make decisions based upon it, because there's a ton of research that we found that the mood you're in influences your decision making, your performance, all sorts of things. And so one of the reasons I'm really happy about being able to talk about it here is for people to know that that exists. So if you've got a friendship going bad, it can infect the entire workplace from that as a source.
But what I hear you saying is that you have to sort of own it, or perhaps even recognize it, which is, let's say you have a meeting with someone and you leave the meeting feeling stress, as you say. Perhaps the question you say is, wonder where that came from,
yes,
right?
Exactly. And so that you don't just – because people are pretty easy at owning them themselves. And this is one thing that happened during the financial crisis, is that we had – you know, everybody was upset. So even if you were sort of okay, you were surrounded by so many people being upset that you're like, well, maybe I really shouldn't invest. Maybe I really – and then that dampens things even more. So yes, understanding that it's happening, you can't always control it because, again, it's subconscious. But you can say, all right, we know something about this, so this is not me, and that makes it better.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. That's Sigal Barsad and Peter Bregman. Do we have you back?
Yes, I'm back on the line.
Okay, and we're just in time to take a break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about friendships at work. And again, our guests, Sigal Barsad from the Wharton School here in Philadelphia, and Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about what's a healthy relationship at work, and chances are you spend more time with your coworkers than you probably do with your friends and probably do with a lot of members of your family. We are talking with Sigal Barsad. She's the Joseph Frank Bernstein Professor of Management at the Wharton School, and her work focuses on emotions and relationships in the workplace. Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. That's a global management consulting firm, and I just found out joining us from a cabin in Big Sur. Is that right, Peter Bregman?
Yep, that's right. That's
good,
why
well,
the
good for you.
Connection's a little spotty.
Well, we will keep our fingers crossed. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Peter, let me go back to you. And Sigal was talking while we lost you about this contagion effect that I guess good feelings, bad feelings can have a contagious effect in the workplace. This, again, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I see that all the time. And I think it speaks to this skill I think we need as workers that's so undersold and underdeveloped in most of us, which I talk about a lot, called emotional courage. You know, emotional courage is the willingness to have a strong emotion but not be controlled by it. So if you have strong fear, do you have the courage to feel that fear and then make smart choices in the context of it without necessarily being thrown around by it? And you know, throughout the day, throughout the week, throughout, you know, times, we have so many strong emotions that we don't even recognize that we have in some ways, and we sort of become controlled by them. And I think when there's, you know, how do you inoculate against that kind of contagion, which is that you can feel it and not be swung by it and then still be able to make strong, smart choices in the context of those emotions.
I mean, it sounds like you're saying is, in a sense, take your emotional temperature.
Yeah, and not only take your emotional temperature, because I think that's true, but can you tolerate? I mean, the reason we do things because our fear throws us into it, or our love, or whatever it is we follow those things because the feeling is so intolerable we have to act on it. So the question is, can I manage to tolerate a strong feeling and not necessarily take an action that will dilute it or follow through on it? And that takes tremendous courage, I think. It's sort of the courage to feel. And that's a way of inoculating ourselves against these sort of emotional contagions that I think Seagal's right. I mean, not only that drive the stock market down as a result of it. I mean, there's real impact to when we act out of our emotions.
And I'm seeing an email, a question about, you know, what should managers do when there's an incompetent person and that's, you know, that's, I guess, having this kind of contagion in the workplace. And, I mean, some people just have a sort of toxic personality. And what should managers do? And do you think they do it enough, Seagal?
Right. So one of the first answers I give in terms of emotional contagion in the workplace has a little bit to do with the courage being talked about, which is that managers need to address it with their employee. Very often, people don't particularly like to give feedback. They don't particularly like to get feedback. It's kind of the gift nobody wants.
Exactly.
And so people don't talk to that toxic employee. You'd be amazed at how often people sort of performance problems around emotions, the folks don't even know that there's an issue. And so the very first step I would take is talk to the person. Now, if you don't have that ability sometimes because there might be a difference in hierarchy, you may not have control of them, then funnily enough, sometimes some of the biological things can help, or attentional things, because contagion is about attention.
Right.
And so it's literally not in any way that would seem weird, but almost averting your gaze so you're not catching that emotion. But I would see that as really kind of a kind of poor second attempt, only if you have to. I would really try to address the issue.
I mean, and what I hear is sort of trying to inoculate. I mean, if you can't address it, sort of inoculate yourself against
the— Or try to contage them back.
Meaning?
Meaning that if they're being very
love-bombing
negative—
Love-bombing them, you mean?
Well, I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but I like the term. Yeah, I mean that you actually try to contage them back and try to have your positivity trump over the negativity.
Well, Peter, you want to weigh in on this? And then I do want to get to some of our callers.
Yeah, sure. I think that this idea of averting your gaze, I sort of like that idea. It's kind of like covering your mouth when you sneeze and you know, not catching it. The thing I would say about the positivity versus negativity is what I have found is almost the reverse, which is that if someone's negative and I'm going to counteract it with positivity, it almost makes them more negative. And the reason is because I'm arguing with their emotion. They have a certain emotion. They're angry about something. And I'm trying to convince them differently. And they might shut down, but they don't get less angry because they haven't really been heard. And I do this thing, which is almost the reverse, which is I'll be negative with them. But what I mean by that is I'll say yes to their negativity. I won't push back against it. I'm not going to grow it, but I'm going to understand what they're going through. Because when they're being negative, if they feel understood at that point, and maybe I'm not disagreeing, maybe I'll just say you have to create space for the positivity to be accepted. And so I'll almost, you know, say yes, and yes, I understand that, and I can see why it would feel this way, and et cetera, to the point where they feel understood and they feel heard. And at that point, they're ready to move on, and I'm ready to move on. But if we don't go through that step, then I find that it just kind of entrenches their negativity more strongly.
Sigal, you want to comment
on
that?
No, I think it's interesting. And actually, I've done some work on what I call affective diversity, which is when people have very different temperaments and how does that influence. Actually, it was with CEO and firm financial performance. And what we found is that when the senior management team were more similar in their emotional temperament or personalities, the company actually made more money.
Wow.
And there was less conflict. So I don't disagree that it can be jarring if you've got somebody who's coming at you in a different way emotionally. I would definitely agree with that. But what my contagion work has found is that the most powerful contagious condition was actually something, and given that you're in Big Sur, you will appreciate this, it's actually something I call the California condition, which is when people are calm and serene, which is a type of positive affect, but that's lower energy. And so it's not a – I didn't envision kind of a fight of the smile against the scowl. but yes, you know, using your emotional intelligence and giving them the space – but also trying to tip the balance in a more subconscious way as well.
I mean, a kind of calm – it sounds like you're talking about a kind of a calm approach.
It's a calm serenity, but there's definitely pleasantness in it. Right. It's not neutral. It's sort of, you know, not quite a beatific smile, but almost.
Peter, let me toss something else on the table here for discussion, which is dealing with lonely people at work, and I'm, you know, I've worked in enough places to know that that's a real thing, and there are people at work who either are isolated or isolate themselves or get isolated by their coworkers. I mean, sometimes it does feel like seventh grade all over again. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking about managers. What can managers do to help be more inclusive for everybody? It's a great question, and you can't answer it. All right, we're going to give you one more try, Peter, and we're going to call you back and try to get you on the line. So let me toss that back to you, Sigal.
Sure, and actually, this is a topic that I'm very, very interested in, and my colleague Håkan Özlük and I did a study on loneliness at work. And loneliness is a feeling that your overall quality of your relationship in that context is not good, and it's incredibly painful. But it's a transient emotion. It's not something like you're not just a lonely person and you can be lonely at work versus otherwise.
Sure.
And what we found was a profound effect of loneliness at work on performance, lowering performance dramatically, actually. And it operated through people's affective commitment to work, so they were less committed to the workplace, and also what we called affiliative behaviors to their peers, meaning they weren't very helpful to their coworkers. Now, this is a really interesting thing about loneliness. People who are lonely really want to get out of that situation.
They don't want to be lonely.
No, they do not want to stay lonely. And there's lots of evidence that they try to change. But the feeling of being lonely actually gets in their way of being able to reach out effectively. And so as they're trying to connect, they're actually disconnecting. And the fact, for example, that we found that people who are more lonely are disconnecting from their peers at work is one piece of evidence. Right. But there's been lots of work showing they're not very good at leaving the loneliness. And so then from a managerial perspective, one of the things that we found was that when we looked at how many friends people had at work and how that influenced their loneliness, it was not an equal line there. And so it was curvilinear, and that you just need one friend to reduce loneliness dramatically. I mean, of course, it's great to have more friends, but you really just need one. And so one thing managers can do is try to promote that. And again, I go back to companionate love, which is if you've got an environment where people are accepting of one another, that might be able to help as well.
Do you think they're friends at work? When people are friends at work, there are things they should not do that they might do with their friends outside of work. They give gossip. I mean, who doesn't gossip? But nonetheless, I'll put that on the table as well. I mean, again, because you're in the workplace and, you know, it might not be the best for the company or the organization.
Well, it's funny. My doctoral student, Shamul Malwani, who's now a professor at UNC, did her whole dissertation on gossip.
And
a whole thing on that. One of the things that we know is that gossip increases friendship because it increases cohesion and good feelings. at the dyadic level.
Meaning one-on-one.
But what she also found is that when it goes throughout an entire group, it's actually really bad for the work relationships. And even one-on-one, another study found that people who have disproportionately high gossip actually have less friendships at work. It's not, you know, but to the point of the sort of, in essence, what you're asking are what are the negative effects of friendship at work? And, you know, you can definitely – there are negative effects. There can be negative effects in terms of favoritism or, you know, if we even think about possibly ethics and people covering for one another. But the research literature that's looked at this, yes, there definitely are. But it just is completely outweighed by the positive overarching effects of our need to affiliate and the good outcomes that come with performance.
Well, we're talking about friendships at work. And again, our guest, Sigal Barsad, is at the Wharton School here in Philadelphia. And we're giving Peter Bregman one more chance to join us by telephone from a cabin in Big Sur. And again, he's CEO of Bregman Partners. That's a global management consulting firm. And we've been going back and forth talking about the qualities of friendship at work. And what I'm hearing from both of my guests is that it's pretty much all good, and not that it is. There aren't some potentials for problems, but largely it's a benefit to everybody, whether that you're the worker, the boss, or the company's bottom line. Peter, we were talking while you were away. We were talking about a number of different things, including the role of gossip. And anything you want to say about that before I get to our callers?
Sure, and I apologize for this phone trouble. I heard the tail end of that from what Sigal was saying, and I agree with you, Sigal. And I think, as I think more about this too, and we're talking about it, the question is also, how do you mitigate the negative potential aspects? I mean, we all agree that having friends and close friendships at work is really useful. How do you mitigate the possible negative impact of it? And I think it has to do with the kinds of skills we have of setting boundaries, the kinds of skills we have of being okay saying to a friend, I can't have this conversation with you because it's a violation of confidentiality, and I know you're my friend, but we can't talk about that. And I think the gossip issue, I think it really requires strong boundaries to say, this is not a conversation I'm willing to be in. And if you tell people that you don't want to have that conversation, they're going to stop gossiping. So you know, as you have those kinds of boundaries, I think it both sustains the relationship, even though it feels maybe a little harsh or they might feel a bit of rejection at the point. Doing that well helps to preserve the friendship and your ability to maintain a friendship at work.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Nancy from Lafayette Hill joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a little different, not a concern, but my experience. I worked in various professions. For 20 years, probably, in journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was at journalism school at Temple, one of the teachers said, you know, they're not very nice to you at the newspapers. And they won't even tell you where the ladies' room is. So don't expect stuff like that. And she was right. Now, I wouldn't say it didn't affect me because it did, but I kind of got out of it what I wanted to get out of it. But I've worked for pharmaceuticals and insurance and different businesses. And they don't care in newspapers. Now, people develop friendships and stuff like that, but no one feels an obligation to be nice.
Well, that's a really broad and interesting statement there. And Sigal, perhaps I'll let you to weigh in on this, whether there are different professions that seem to either support the development of friendships or positive relationships at work. I know you've looked sort of across the board.
Yeah, so interestingly, in our Companionate Love study, one of the first questions we got was, okay, this is long-term care, but you know, how is it going to be influenced in the type of things that our caller is talking about? And so we did an additional study of about 5,000 people across 7 industries looking at the same concepts and found the same outcomes, which is that the higher a culture of companion love they had, the more committed, the more satisfied. And what I would say to our caller is I hear you, and I think that there are many workplaces – I don't think it's – actually, we found more variance within industry than across industry. So I don't think it's necessarily about industry, but there's certainly – many companies who aren't doing this. And the one thing I would just say is that imagine your 20 years in your career, if you had been in that kind of context, what kind of differences might that have made for your work life?
Yeah, Nancy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. So let me just say that it's certainly not that way here at WHYY, a very friendly and helpful place. If I can just add that. Peter, something I was talking with Sigal about before we went on the air, about thinking about our workplace as a kind of surrogate family. I don't know whether you think that's a good idea, if that makes any sense or not, but I'd just be curious your thoughts about that.
You know, I think it is sort of a surrogate family in some ways. You have close relationships with people. You have shared responsibilities with them. You have, you know, you can even think of the family as a shared workplace. You know, when I think of my relationship with my wife, you know, we have love and we have close friendship, and we also have to negotiate responsibilities, and we have to sort of figure out who's going to do what and how we're going to accomplish it and whether it's going well. And so I think the lines, especially in modern society, really begin to blend in terms of, you know, who you are as a family and who you are as sort of work colleagues. And I know I find that to be true myself with people that I work with as well as my family. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's true, and I think people like to create certain kinds of boundaries that make them feel safer, right? And so, you know, I don't go out to drink with people who work with me, or I don't do this, or I don't do that, in order to keep those lines really clear. And sometimes that's smart from their perspective because they know they can't trust their decision-making if they're too close with people. Or that, you know, I have the CEO that I work with who really doesn't want to have friends in the senior level because he feels like he starts to make poor decisions related to that. He's not going to fire someone when he needs to fire them because he's close friends with them. And I think understanding yourself well enough to know how you respond in situations is really useful as well.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners, a global management consulting firm. He's a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review and Forbes and Psychology Today. Also with us, Sigal Barsage. She's the Joseph Frank Bernstein Professor of Management at the Wharton School, where her work focuses on emotions and relationships in the workplace. That's what we're talking about on Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about friendships at work. We probably spend more time certainly at work than we do in a lot of other parts of our lives and spend more time with our colleagues than we probably do a lot of our friends and maybe even a lot of our family as well. We're talking about what is a healthy office friendship, why are they important, and how can managers foster a culture that encourages good relationships with and among employees. And we want to hear from you at phone at 1-888-477-94. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. I have a bit of a complicated situation, but I'm going to read this, and Sigal, I'll give you a chance to respond first. And this is someone that wants to remain anonymous. What do your guests suggest for the situation where, in a department of four people, three have bonded over the shared offense taken to the fourth coworker who consistently makes rude, condescending, and patronizing statements to the others, and where discussion with the boss about this fourth person will not have any effect? So you've got four people working together. One of them seems to be making these rude, condescending, and patronizing statements. The other three have bonded together. The boss isn't doing anything about it. What do you suggest they do, Sigal?
Right. So, you know, this falls in line with emotional intelligence, something that I teach a lot at Wharton. And one of the first things that I say is that, again, when somebody is behaving in this way, we often assume that they understand that they're being terrible,
rude, and
difficult.
And
exactly.
That stuff.
But part of being low emotional intelligence is that you don't actually necessarily know that you're doing it. And so this relates in an interpersonal way, I think, to Peter's point about emotional courage. You know, Peter was talking about it intrapsychically. And if we think about emotional regulation, there are two pieces to that. One is the intrapsychic, and I would completely agree. And then there's the interpersonal piece, which is having the courage to do that. Now, of course, when it's a peer, what complicates this is the manager piece. But what I would say is also there are three of them. I mean, and you have to think carefully about how you do it, and you don't want to ambush. But the first step is really to, in a very respectful way, to lay out, you know, what they're feeling and why and how. And sometimes the things that the person is doing to be condescending and difficult, they're hard to put your finger on because they're what are called micro inequities. They're small things that it's hard to say, well, when we were in that meeting, you rolled your eyes and you leaned back and you looked at your smartphone five times and yawned loudly. But the ability to have that, at least that first conversation, because the bonding of the three against the one is a recipe for disaster.
Peter, let me put something else on the table here. And I'm thinking about things that companies and organizations do to try to deal with office morale and to deal with making sure that people feel that they are part of the organization. What are some of effective ways to do that? And there certainly are retreats and there are ways of, you know, playing games with each other. Do you have a something that you think is works broadly speaking?
Yeah, I used to do a lot of these games. I used to work with Outward Bound and I used to have my own company doing kind of teamwork stuff outdoors. And I'm not actually a huge proponent of that stuff anymore. I find that it's fun and it develops a nice relationship outside of work, but it doesn't translate into work. Sigal, I don't know if you've done any research
yeah,
around this.
There's okay. evidence of that. Yeah.
Yeah, she's nodding her head vigorously, Peter.
Yeah. So I'm very into strategy offsites and I'm into bringing people together, but not to just play games. So what I feel like we need to do is work together to address and grapple with and wrestle with real problems that we're facing as a business, as partners in the business, as individuals, and that when we grapple with those problems together and help to sort of solve them or resolve them or deal with them in real ways, then that does translate. So, you know, I'll do strategy offsites with organizations. And we're not playing games. We're going to sit there going, what are the three biggest issues we're facing? Or here's one, what are the undiscussables? What are the things that we don't talk about? Sometimes I'll go around and I'll talk to everyone individually, and they'll talk with me, and they'll tell me these are things we don't talk about. And then we get into a room, and I'll throw them on the table, and I go, let's talk about them.
Oh, wow.
And in dealing with those things in real ways, including in dealing with the emotions that come up when people deal with it, that I find in that way people begin to connect more deeply and are able to work together in a more powerful way because they're actually doing it, but they're just doing it with a little bit of support.
Go ahead, Sigal.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I think that the team development and the relationships and the trust, because the basis of friendship is trust, or at least that's the basis of one type of friendship. And so exactly, doing something like that builds trust within that environment. The only thing I would say, though, about the games piece is it depends both what you're using it for and how you translate it back into the workplace. And I think that Peter's right that in a lot of situations, you know, it's very separate and then it doesn't get translated back well. But if you're using it to, for example, build some initial trust or just almost ice breaking, and then if you're good at tying it back into the kind of work he's doing now, I think that they can be useful, but it has to be used judiciously.
But what I hear you say, I mean, trust is a very important
trust is key.
Emotion to have or a
in
feeling,
friendship.
I guess, to have in friendship
yes.
and at work as well.
Yes, and when friendships go sour very often, it is because of a betrayal or a loss of trust.
Let me get, looks like Anastasia from Newark, Delaware, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Anastasia. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome.
I am in academia, and something that I struggle with is that I find it's easy to fall into this trap where it is a badge of professionalism to profess or to feel stress.
Yeah.
How can you fight a workplace where you might not feel like you're an authentic professional unless you are performing and talking about how you are feeling these negative emotions of stress and anxiety?
Well, Anastasia, I'm going to toss that to Peter. And Peter, the world is listening for your answer. Go ahead.
I mean, I think it's such a great question. I think that we have become a culture that thrives on, I will not extricate myself from this group. I'm not going to say that I'm different. This is something I've really faced about myself and realized that I'm so busy. There is so much to do. And And so the question is, why don't I slow down? I could slow down. Sure. I run my own business. I create my own schedule. I can slow down. And there's something that makes me feel comfortable about being so busy. And it also makes me comfortable to let other people know that I'm so busy, because that way, you know, I can kind of feel good about myself, and I can feel like I'm working really hard and I'm achieving. And so I'm going to bring this back to emotional courage. I'm going to bring it back to emotions in general, which is, am I willing, you know, can I break the cycle for myself? Am I willing to say, I'm not going to be so busy, and I'm going to feel what it's like to leisurely go to a meeting and not be rushing there on my bicycle and on my phone at the same time while trying to, you know, I mean, doing everything that I write about, that I write against, right? I mean, everything that I write against. We know multitasking doesn't work. We know that, you know, trying to move too fast runs into problems, both in terms of, you know, ethical choices we make in the moment and in mistakes that we make in the moment. I mean, we know this stuff doesn't work, and yet we do it because it makes us feel more comfortable mm-hmm. to do it. So, you know, my challenge would be to try to approach it differently yourself and see what that feels like for you, to actually not engage in the conversation about how stressed you are. Let other people and see what it feels like for you to slow down your schedule and not be so stressed, and maybe be part of those conversations still. And what does that bring up in you? Because that's the richness of life in many ways. And when you start to do it, you may get criticism from other people, or they may actually want to hang out with you a little bit more because they want a little bit of what you've got. I think it's a really interesting and important question.
I agree, and I want to take it back to friendship and take it back to you, Sigal, because if you're feeling stress and you don't have time for anything, you really don't feel like you have time to nurture a friendship or even to have a friendship.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that we found is that friendship comes at work when you're actually able to spend the time, and friendships deteriorate when you're scattered and doing other things. And also, researchers have also found that the biggest precursor to friendship in terms of technology or meeting is face-to-face interaction. And so it trumps by far every other type of interaction. It's followed by telephone, and then by email, and then by texting, and then instant messaging, by the way, is at the very bottom, which is interesting, given that you would think that it's real time, but no, it's like it's the least likely to form a friendship. And so, you know, and to Peter's point, last week somebody asked me, so how are you doing? And I got so tired of saying how busy I was that I said, you know what? I'm incredibly relaxed and things are going so well. And I said it a little more authentically than I just managed to now. And they stopped in their tracks.
Said, really?
What's your secret?
Right?
You know, and so you know, that's the specific point to the stress piece. I would say more broadly, if you're in a culture that the emotional culture is not matching you, it is worth thinking about whether you want to switch. And I've had friends in academia who've been in very negative emotional cultures who ultimately switched out and felt great because that wasn't what they wanted.
I'm wondering too, and Peter, let me toss this to you, and then I'll get back to our callers here, which is sometimes when you're really close, and perhaps I'm speaking for myself here, when you're close with people at work and then you meet them outside of work, it can feel sometimes a little awkward because you're kind of out of time and place, and the relationship that you have is sort of built around all of the things you do at work, and then all of a sudden there you are, you know, in the same restaurant together or something like that.
Yeah, and I think actually I want to tie that in. It's a good question, and I want to tie it in with something Sigal just mentioned around the different ways we communicate, right? Because it makes complete sense to me that texting is at the bottom of the list in terms of how we feel about each other, the kinds of friendships that we develop, because texting is as transactional as it gets, or instant messaging is as transactional as it gets. Meaning, you know, I've got a tweet, I've got a couple of sentences I'm just going to throw out there, and it's rare that we use instant messaging to share an emotion of gratitude to someone or connection or something, and that friendship develops because we're more relational than transactional. Now, the moment at which we can see each other as human beings and have a conversation that relates to who you are, and this comes back to what Seagal was saying at the very beginning, you know, the tenderness or the caring, or, you know, when I can show that, and I can show that face-to-face much more comfortably than I do in an instant message, or, you know, you could do it in emails, but you have to be pretty good. And so what happens when you go outside and you're, you know, you're going for a drink or you're going for dinner is it's almost all relational and very little transactional. Like, you might just be doing business, and if you were, then you'd probably be in your comfort zone. But if you're going out with friends just as friends, you're seeing them and dealing with them as a human being more than as a work partner trying to accomplish something.
Let me get
to how you develop a relationship, but it's also a very different kind of relationship.
I hear you. Let me get Drew from, looks like Westtown, to join our conversation. Hi, Drew. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the air.
You're welcome.
I've been a CMO for the last 12 years and an advertising executive for about 15 years before that. And I've been openly gay for the entire 30 years of my career. And, you know, what I found is that yes, we, you know, I operate at a very high level and have a diverse staff, either reporting directly to me or interact with other departments in the company that require real sort of connectivity. But what I've also found is that, and I have a job to do, and so I'm very, very, you know, focused and direct and clear as best as I can be with the direction and expectations that I have with my staff. And when I'm in that mode, so to speak, I am very focused, and some might say oftentimes intimidating, but what I also try to do from time to time is to break that, not necessarily in mid-meeting, but at other times during my interactions with my staff, and just, you know, be human, you know, and have my goofy side come out and let people know that, you know, I am a person just like them. I also think this notion of emotional intelligence is really another way of saying how self-aware employees are. And I think that's something that management has to encourage and grow within their employees, because not everybody comes to the company with the same level of self-awareness, if any at all. And when you see that, when you see a staff has intelligence capability, but what they lack is sort of awareness of their own, you know, impact on others, you know, you have to take time to work with them at their own level, almost on a therapist type level, and say, look, you know, you have to begin to understand how you're being perceived and how that, you know, can get in the way of what you believe or what is their talent.
Well, Drew, let me take your point, and only because we have about a minute left here. And I like when he said, Seagal, sort of understanding your impact on others.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, when one of the things in emotional intelligence, one of the first levels is your own self-awareness and your ability to read others and express your own emotions. And your ability – sometimes people come to work and they're – and it's a little bit similar to what Drew was saying, which is either they get in the zone or they feel like they have a role they need to play. And what happens then is they become inauthentic. They start to send different signals emotionally than they are actually cognitively, and it confuses people. And so it's important that within what's appropriate for work – you stay as transparent as possible. And cognitively transparent, meaning say what you mean, and emotionally transparent means show what you feel within what is appropriate for the workplace, and to pay attention to that. And I would agree it should be nurtured more.
Well, you know, we could go on, but we do have to end our discussion. Seagal Barsad, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And she's the Joseph Frank Bernstein Professor of Management at the Wharton School, and her research focuses on emotions and relationships in the workplace. Peter Bregman, thank you very much for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. CEO of Bregman Partners, also the author most recently of a book called 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distraction, and Get the Right Things Done. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Also, join me next Tuesday night for Radio Times on the Road. We're taking the show to the Haverford School in Haverford, Pennsylvania, to discuss and dissect the midterm elections. For information about how to be part of the audience, go to whyy.org/meetmarty. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.